Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Sustaining Success Steps to Maintaining Compliance Check Operations Conference. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I'll turn the call over to your host, R.J. Elric. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Ruthie. Hello, and welcome to today's program. I'm R.J. Elric with the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation and the Underage Drinking Enforcement Training Center. This program is part of a continuing series of audio teleconference presentations that are produced by the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation in cooperation with the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, or OJJDP, in support of our Enforcing Underage Drinking Laws program. Before we begin today's call, I'd like to let our listeners know that our audio teleconference is being recorded and will be available for later download and listening from our website. During the presentations from our guests, you, the audience, will be in a listen mode only. We will invite our listeners to ask questions of our panel at the end of the program, so I would ask that you think about and formulate your questions early on in the presentation. At this point, I'd like to ask our operator to take a moment and provide instructions to our listeners on how you can pose questions when we reach the Q&A portion of this presentation. Ruthie?
And ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question today, you may signal by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. Once again, that is star 1 for questions. We'd like to remind everyone, if you're using a speakerphone, to please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Following today's call, the registrants will receive an email asking for your assessment of today's presentation. This is important to us, and we'd ask that you respond to the email at your earliest convenience, and would like to thank you in advance for your feedback. For those of you who have computers with Internet access, you can follow along in our presentation by going to the following website, https://pire, that's P-I-R-E, dot ilink, I-L-I-N-C, .com/join/xyjkvcv. You'll click on the join a meeting. When you reach that screen, it'll ask for some information, your name, your email address, and then you'll need to enter the following PIN number, 7268549. Please note that if you're using a dial-up connection to the Internet, you may experience a delay in the slides as they appear on your screen. We also have a chat feature available on this web presentation where you, the participants, can ask questions and make comments. Please know that PIRE monitors do not moderate this chat box. We're not discouraging you from using the feature. However, we cannot assure you that the information that you may receive through the chat box is the most up-to-date or correct information. We'd also like to note that the views of today's presenters are not necessarily the views of OJJDP or the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation. Following today's presentations, if you have questions that are not answered, please feel free to contact me at relric@pire.org. That's R-E-L-R-I-C-K at pire.org. I'd be happy to follow up with you and provide the information to you. As we stated, today's call is titled Sustaining Success, Steps to Maintaining Compliance Check Operations. We know that it's one thing to design and implement a new compliance check operation. It's a greater challenge to sustain that program at a time when budgets and staffing are being reduced. What steps can you take to minimize the impact of these diminishing resources? Where do you turn to get assistance? More importantly, what creative funding mechanisms might exist to help keep your programs alive? This dialogue will take a look at examples of successful compliance check operations and discuss the creative means by which the programs have continued in challenging times and communities. We'll look at the impact of leadership support and see how that makes a difference between a successful compliance check operation and one that simply does not survive. Let us stop now with share collectively some ideas to keep your compliance checks alive and successful. We're fortunate today to have with us experienced members of both the community and the law enforcement organizations that have a great deal of information to share on this very topic. Our first panel comes to us from South Carolina. We'll have three presenters. The first is Michael George. Michael is employed by PIRE as the State Alcohol Enforcement Team Liaison in South Carolina, a statewide underage drinking enforcement and education initiative which is operated under the auspices of the South Carolina Department of Alcohol and other drug abuse services. With 29 years of experience working in local and state law enforcement, Michael holds a master's degree in justice and public safety, a bachelor's degree in political science, and is finishing a PhD in public policy and administration. He's begun work on his dissertation research on leadership styles within the law enforcement work teams. The second member of our panel is Mary Lynn Tollison. Mary Lynn is currently serving as the Alcohol Enforcement Team Coordinator for the 7th Judicial District, which includes Spartanburg and Cherokee counties in South Carolina. She began her career in drug and alcohol prevention services in South Carolina in 1985. The last 14 years of her career, she has worked with the Spartanburg Alcohol and Drug Abuse Commission in community and environmental prevention strategies with policy development, compliance initiatives, and community capacity building. She's a certified senior prevention professional with a BS in social work. And rounding out our first panel is Deputy Danny Blackwell. Deputy Blackwell is a deputy sheriff with the Spartanburg County Sheriff's Office in South Carolina. A law enforcement officer for 5.5 years, he serves as a liaison to the Spartanburg Alcohol and Drug Abuse Commission, and as such is the lead officer of the Tobacco and Alcohol Compliance Team. He supervises the Drug Court Program and is a member of the South Carolina State Alcohol Enforcement Training Team. With a bachelor's degree in theology, he's attended numerous advanced training classes in law enforcement. We greatly appreciate that each of the members of this panel have taken time from their busy schedules to be with us today and share with you, our audience, some of the keys to maintaining our compliance check operations in these difficult fiscal times. We'll begin our discussion with Mr. Michael George as he describes some of the successful efforts that we're seeing in the state of South Carolina. Mr. George?
Thank you. South Carolina had some upgrades to their underage drinking law in 2007. Our General Assembly passed a number of upgrades to our law, including keg registration, some other things. And with that that passage of that law, we were also, through the Department of Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse Services, DAOTUS, was granted some funding to provide to local circuits, judicial circuits, to set up alcohol enforcement teams. Now, we'd already had a 4 or 5 teams set up in South Carolina. We knew one of the ways to raise the bar in South Carolina was actually have a statewide emphasis with the local initiatives, local officers, and community coalitions. Those community coalitions involved, of course, law enforcement, behavioral prevention specialists, and we pretty much had the parameters set up where each local initiative could involve their coalition as they saw fit, and a number of folks such as merchants and civic and faith-based groups, policymakers, those type of people, even the parents and students, had been a member of the coalitions. So within a period of about 2 or 3 months, in the latter part of 2007, we had all 16 ATs, alcohol enforcement teams, set up. And they, as I said earlier, were set up by our judicial circuits that cover our 46 counties in South Carolina. The thing that DAOTUS did at the state level was provided some very limited parameters. The first thing that we asked the ATs to do to be involved in are compliance checks, to look at their data in their particular local community to set up initiatives based on that local emphasis. We also, through the UDTC Training Center, established regional training based on that national model provided by UDTC, and because we knew we needed to build capacity among our law enforcement officers in our state. Like many states, our Criminal Justice Academy does a great job of training, but they don't provide the training to officers to understand the things that need to be done as it relates to underage drinking, so that was the reason why we set up the training. And I will say, since 2007, we've trained almost 1,100 officers in our state through those regional trainings. Most of the time, the training are 2 days. In some occasions, we've, depending on the emphasis, we've limited it to 1 day. But through that pattern of setting up through since 2007, we've been able to do those trainings. We also provide technical assistance to alcohol enforcement teams. A number of teams were able to sustain their efforts without any assistance, but in some cases we've been able to help introduce them to some of their local law enforcement to build those teams together to work together. And then the other thing that we've done at the state level is work to develop statewide partners, such as our Highway Patrol and our Parks and Recreations and our Department of Natural Resources. Those folks are at the local level, but they have statewide or state offices that lead their teams in the local communities. And those folks have been able to come on board as we've been able to gain the partners. And I will add that we continue at the state level to look for additional partners to be a part of our effort. We know that it doesn't just involve law enforcement at the local level and community coalitions and any other partners that we can have that have the same sort of issues with underage drinking. Then we can have a better better and more effective strategic plan. We've also used data. Some of the data that we've used is the YRBS surveys to understand a little bit better about what youth are doing. We've also been able to use that data to provide to our local AETs teams about where the youth in their communities are getting alcohol, and that way they can pattern the compliance checks and public safety checkpoints to other enforcement activities that help get to the access of and limit access to the alcohol for those underage drinkers. Last year we had a one of our AET team circuit coordinators suggested that we do high visibility enforcement mobilization. And really the bottom line of the high visibility enforcement is strict enforcement coupled with a strong media message. And we developed last year, working together with all our AETs, an out of their hands campaign. We did it during the springtime for prom season. We asked all our AETs, all 16 AETs, to be involved and at a minimum to hold compliance checks and also be involved in media events. We knew that through this statewide emphasis, once again, bringing together our local folks, this partnership between the state and the local law enforcement and prevention specialists would be successful. And matter of fact, during our prom season last year in April, we held that high visibility enforcement, and we did not have any deaths. And in previous years, we'd had deaths due to alcohol, but we didn't have any deaths last year. So we consider it a success, and we will continue to do that sort of thing. I'm going to turn it over to our local folks from Spartanburg, Cherokee County, to talk about their initiatives.
Thank you, Michael. Just like to start off, first of all, by talking a little bit about the two counties that the Seventh Circuit serves here. First of all, we serve both a rural and a urban county, Spartanburg obviously being the larger of the two, population-wise, area-wise. We do serve both of those counties. And in the beginning, first of all, we had a change in sheriff here, which is sometimes a cataclysmic event in some people's opinion. But basically with the change of sheriff, our sheriff kind of got on board here in our local area. And his leadership has been key to our effort here because in the original effort, we had grant dollars. We had a pretty good sum of money to start with. The sheriff appointed me as a liaison officer here. We went through that whole grant process. And over the last couple of years, those grant funds have diminished, but our sheriff's initiatives and his desire to see the young people of our county protected from underage consumption, those kind of things, has not diminished, and he has still allowed me to work here and be assigned here. He has appointed me as liaison, like I said. Now he's actually starting to allow us, since our granddaughters have fallen off, and they're not allowed to actually pay off the officers to do compliance checks and those kind of things. He actually has allowed some limited overtime use, which is a big step forward as far as it is continuing our efforts here. We also have deputies that we have assigned to the local effort here, the TAC team, we call them, Tobacco and Alcohol Compliance Team. A lot of those officers volunteer their time. Some of them work for comp time. Some of them, just to be honest with you, just come out and work as volunteers and don't get paid at all. We do have some limited dollars. We pay some overtime or some off-duty time for those law enforcement officers. We've also made use of some of our local law enforcement officers here, not only the county officers, but we have partnership with several of the colleges here, USCF State being the largest of those. They have supplies with officers. Their members of their police officers, police office there is actually on our team. We have some limited participation from the city police officers here in Spartanburg City. They help us with some training efforts and those kind of things. And when the initiative first started, they actually would go out and do compliance checks and operations with us. Now they're involved mainly in the training aspects of those things. So they have been key to as keeping our sustainability going here in our local area. SADAC obviously is the houses my office, and they help us with as far as keeping the facts and figures and those kind of things. We supply the officers. Just talk a little bit about compliance checks, what they are. Some people on the conference call, they may not actually be involved in compliance checks, but I'll just kind of give you a brief rundown of how we conduct them. Obviously, when a young person comes in, we're here obviously trying to prevent underage drinking. That's a no-brainer here. But the compliance check operations involve us taking an actual person under the age of 21 into a local establishment, whether it be an on-premise or off-premise, whether it be a bar, restaurant, whether it be a convenience store, that kind of thing. They're not allowed to lie about their age. They have to use their actual ID. They go in and select a predetermined product, whether it be a beer, an alcohol pop, whether it be wine or hard liquor. We tell them what to choose. They take that product to the counter. They attempt to purchase. They're not allowed to try to talk the clerk into selling to them. Basically, all they do is put it on the counter and attempt to purchase. If that purchase is made, then, of course, we take the appropriate measures. When we first started this initiative, we done what's called a red card, green card. Basically, for the first year, our sheriff said, we don't want to just go in and start dropping a hammer on these folks. First thing we want to do is kind of give them a shot over the bow, give them a warning. So for the first year, we go into an establishment. If they made a sale, we give them a red card. The red card was just basically cardboard, a postcard-sized note, had some basic information about the law, some penalties that they could have incurred by not being obedient to the law, and just basically said, this is your warning. We will be back. That information was kept up with for a year. Went to an establishment, and they did not make a sale, and then we gave them a green card. That's just basically a thank you card. Thank you for doing a good job. Give this to your manager. Give them attaboy. Thanks for doing what you're supposed to be doing. We continue that effort now, even though we're now starting to write citations. We've been writing citations now for about 2 years or so. We still do that red card, green card. That does several things for us. Number one, it gives us information. Number two, it notifies the management of what's going on. And number three, it gives some immediate feedback to the folks that are actually being dealt with as far as law enforcement. And it's an education tool. Compliance checks, our focus here is not to write more tickets or try to get more charges. Our goal is to save lives, which I think is the goal of everybody involved in this effort. And so our goal here, our push here, is the education part, which when we go and do a compliance check, anytime a citation is issued or anytime we do a compliance check, we try to offer them a Department of Revenue approved merchant education program. The one that we use most here is called PREP, Palmetto Retail Education Program. The officers are involved in this program. It's taught by, obviously, police officers that have been trained in this program. It's training specific to South Carolina law. It's not in general. It's specific to South Carolina law. And they will be required, if they have a citation, to complete this Department of Revenue approved education program, which is one of five in our state. We give them that information right on the scene. We give them information as to who to contact, when that next program is going to be taking place. If they actually complete the training prior to coming to court, our judge offers them a reduction in fine as far as them completing this program. So it's basically, again, an effort to get them more education. And, of course, you'll see there on one of the slides here basically what we offer them. Anytime we go in, we give them this flyer, basically has information on it about the PREP training. On the back of the flyer will be a map to the location. And again, there is a small cost to the individual, but again, they are offered a reduction in fine if they complete that merchant education program. That's basically kind of what we do here at the Sheriff's Office and what we do with the prep training. At this time, I'll pass it over to Mary Lynn.
And I serve as the AEC coordinator, and oftentimes you may ask, how do the officers know which direction to go when they're out doing compliance checks? What's the most cost-effective method for determining what route you go? In Spartanburg County alone, we have over 700 licensed establishments that sell alcohol, so therefore, you know, there's a lot of variance in directions we can go. We are currently using a data system that we have developed through an Excel document that lists all the establishments, the date that they were visited, the type of person that visited the location, the date, whether they sold, whether they did not sell. And it is our policy that we revisit those locations within 60 days if they were red carded or sold during that period of time. We think it's important that we keep that document, and to us, that's one of our most cost-effective documents because we're not just having officers driving around the community looking for random selection, but we're targeting a neighborhood, we're targeting a direction, and we're very, very specific about where we want to go. We also think it's important, and it's been a really cost-effective thing, and that's here with management, that we want them to be taking seriously with us our goal to be at 10% compliance rate. We visit locations. We provide them their overall buy rate. If they've been visited multiple times through letter or through personal visit, we will share with them what their individual store compliance rate might be, whether it's 50% or 20%. The goal in doing that and sharing with those corporate managers or individual store managers is that we can't have a 10% compliance rate or below if their location in and of itself is at a 50% rate. So if they're at 10%, then our goal can be 10% or below. And so by sharing that information with them, we think that that involves the business themselves. I will also share with you our coalition involvement. Initially, when we had a large amount of money, it was very easy for us to have materials, printing, travel, and those kinds of things. But as funds were diminished, and as we know, funds were decreased, it was imperative that we delegate some of the printing, material, collaborative, capacity-building components of the enforcement piece to other community partners. So right now, we are partnering with our Drug-Free Communities Grant. We also are partnering with the Spartanburg Prevention of Underage Drinking Collaboration. And those people are delegated in providing our media, our printing, our travel, those things excluding the enforcement component. And you can notice here that the mock party patrol to train officers at one of the local universities was provided. The funding was provided through Drug-Free Community Grant and some of our billboard, our advertising, our CAKE initiative, which that our collaboration is involved in to educate parents. All of that is taken on by our local collaborative. So by partnering, when we initially had $100,000 and now we're looking at a budget of half of that, we're able to pull that in. And in reality, we've not lost any funding because our collaborations have joined with us in providing the printing, the media, and the social marketing that goes along with our enforcement efforts. Enforcement in and of itself is just, you know, one piece of the pie, but having that collaborative, the capacity building, and all that is essential. And our community has really bought into the fact that in order for us to do compliance and in order for us to meet the goal of having a low compliance rate, that community involvement is vital. That's South Carolina.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, before we go further, I want to just, for those of you who may have joined our audio call late, tell you that our topic today is sustaining success, steps to maintaining compliance check operations. And Ruthie, could you just remind our visitors how they might go about asking questions?
Absolutely. If you'd like to ask a question today, you may signal by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. That's star 1 to ask a question.
Thank you. We've heard how one state has worked to maintain their compliance check operations with some key leadership support. Perhaps some of you in states where funding is threatening your ability to maintain your compliance checks and other underage drinking enforcement efforts are wondering about some other creative ideas. In the state of Nevada, legislative change and good planning created a new funding stream that would support underage drinking enforcement efforts. For the second half of our presentation, I'd like to welcome our second panel, John Schutt with the Las Vegas Police Department, and Kathy Bartos, who's the state UTIL coordinator in the state of Nevada. Officer John Schutt has been a police officer with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department for 11 and a half years. He's been with the department as their lead officer for the UTIL, Enforcing Underage Drinking Laws, since 2002, and organizes all of the department's alcohol compliance checks, third-party interventions, and party dispersals. In 2007, John became a trainer with PIRE, and currently conducts all of the training within the state of Nevada. He's worked at several of the national training conferences put on by OJJDP and PIRE. He recently completed all of the coursework for a Master of Arts in Political Science at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, with only his thesis remaining. He's very active within the judicial and legislative arenas within Nevada and is responsible for changes in several laws and the judicial processes. Kathy Bartos has served as the Nevada Statewide Enforcing Underage Drinking Laws Coordinator since 1999. During that time, she has written and received 8 UTIL Discretionary Grant Awards. Prior to her current position, she was a prevention specialist for the Nevada Bureau of Alcohol and Drug Abuse for 13 years and a special education teacher at a junior high for 8 years. She has a master's degree in public administration from the University of Nevada, Reno, and a Bachelor of Arts in Education from the University of New Mexico at Albuquerque. She served on numerous statewide, regional, and national prevention task forces throughout her career. She's received the Nevada Prevention Outstanding Contributor Award 3 times in 93, 2000, and again in 2007. Let's hear from the state of Nevada. How has this new law come to be?
Hi, this is Kathy Bartos. Thank you for the glowing picture. I was hoping you guys were going to put in a picture of Alfred E. Newman for me, but I can see, you know, you've got to roll with a sense of humor here every now and then. We're going to talk a little bit about the Nevada Revised Statute, and John and I will sort of split up the PowerPoints as we go through this. What we did is, just so for those of you that have not had the opportunity of visiting our glorious state, Nevada only has 17 counties. One of the counties, Clark County, which encompasses Las Vegas and the surrounding communities, holds about, help me out here, John, wouldn't you say it's close to 72 to 75% of the total state of Nevada population?
Correct. Yeah.
The other one is Washoe County up north, or actually in the elbow of Nevada, and that is Washoe County, which encompasses Reno and Sparks and a few surrounding communities. That is home to, oh, I would say about 15% of the population. The remaining population is scattered throughout 15 rural counties, including Carson City and Elko might be two of the names you'd recognize. I don't think you'd recognize Beowawe or Winnemucca, but that pretty much describes Nevada. Those two counties, Washoe and Clark County, are the only counties in Nevada that have more than 100,000 people. So what we did is we submitted a bill to enforce mandatory responsible beverage server training and had it applicable to counties over 100,000 people. So that immediately brought Washoe County and Clark County under that umbrella. So that right there, going back and trying to do my math over again, that affects about 90% of our businesses and our population. What this responsible beverage server training required was that an owner of an establishment, now follow along on the bouncing ball here, we are now on slide 2, an owner of an establishment must ensure that anyone hired to sell alcoholic beverages, and this is for both our on-premise and our off-premise consumption places, they must complete a certification process that is certified by the state, and they must do that within 30 days of hire. Now, like I said already, the law only applies to those two counties so far. Other counties can join on voluntarily if they would like to. Now, what's interesting about this, and it's the Post-Secondary Education Commission, much to their chagrin, was given the responsibility of certifying these responsible beverage server training courses. They are about 2 to 3 hours long, and they include everything from consequences of drinking for the individual and society, how to refuse an inebriated patron from more drinks, and how to avoid sales to minors, including fake ID identification and local state laws. So there you go. That's sort of the course in a nutshell. Those passing the course, they get a card that has to be laminated with their picture on it, and it's good for 4 years anywhere in Nevada. So if someone from Clark County moves to Washoe, then that card will be honored there. The cost of the course cannot exceed $40. Now, John, how about if I turn it over to you, and you can talk about violation?
Sure.
Okay.
One of the interesting things about the state of Nevada, because I'm sure many of you are thinking, wow, I could never get this bill to pass in my state, but wouldn't it be great? One of the little games they play in the Nevada legislature is, hey, let's get all the other counties on board by passing a bill that only affects the counties with more than 100,000 in the population, which, as Kathy stated earlier, that's only two counties. So it's kind of like all the minority gets to actually gang up on the majority here in the state of Nevada, which is how they actually got this bill passed. So when you have the majority of the counties excluded in the bill, they can actually pass laws that affect the majority of the population in the state of Nevada. And most of the time, such as in this case, that works out great for us. When this bill passed, it was up to the Department of Taxation in Nevada, due to the fact that Nevada does not have an alcohol control board or an ABC agency. It was up to the Department of Taxation for Nevada to issue the infraction forms. And like most other states, you can imagine the state of Nevada, that's very few employees. Kathy, do you know exactly how many they have?
No, I don't.
No, we're talking probably under 10.
Yeah.
And for the entire state, you can imagine Las Vegas alone has over 2.5 million people. There's no way they can get that on. So a change was made which allowed local peace officers throughout the state to actually issue this form, which is a new concept because places like Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department do not traditionally write civil infractions or civil violations. We don't deal with any realm of civil law here in Las Vegas. The police departments don't. So things had to be changed and worked out on that realm. But it allowed for us to simply fill out the form, sign it, post it in a location for the owner of the business, and then the form actually goes to the Nevada Department of Taxation. They are the ones who complete the paperwork, and they are the ones imposing the fine. It's not the police department, like in a normal criminal citation. One other thing that was really beneficial about this law, and law enforcement all throughout the state was happy to finally have a tool where we could go after the owner of a business. In Nevada, when you obviously write a citation for providing liquor to a minor, you are only citing that individual clerk or that bartender. And there's no real incentive for the owner to either fire that clerk or to really care in any way because these citations didn't go against the business or the owner, except maybe when it came time for a renewal of a business license, they can maybe bring up the fact that there's three or four citations have been issued at your location. So this law in and of itself was just an outstanding tool for us as law enforcement because we were finally able to have something where we actually go and find the owner of the business themselves. And that's what this tool did for us. The next slide here is basic information on the form. It's one of the most simple forms to fill out. It just has the date and time of violation. And again, every single individual that serves or deals with the alcohol in an establishment or a convenience store, and in the case of a bar or club, this includes their security guards. They are required to attend this training class. And if they fail to have that card on them, at the time officers or members of the Department of Taxation respond to their location, then they are issued this civil infraction notice against the owner. And it's your basic information, the date, time of violation, the owner name of the establishment, the location, and all the things you see on the slide here, and information on how the infraction itself was served.
Okay, and then if you go to the next slide, it shows what the amounts are of the fines. And this is within a 24-month period, which is pretty strict.
Very.
So first violation is $500, second violation $1,000, third violation $5,000. So it's pretty steep, and it makes it so it's enough of an incentive for these businesses to really pay attention. The fines that are collected by this, and this is where we got pretty excited. We were able to negotiate with where those the funds collected by the department, where they would go. The two law enforcement agencies in Washoe and Clark County did not want them going back directly into their kitty, because if it did, it would look like it was a real self-serving sort of a bill, that they're trying to make money for themselves. So instead, 50% must be deposited within the state treasurer for credit to the account for aid for victims of domestic violence. The other 50% must be deposited into our state UDL account. So we're really thrilled that we might have a possible windfall of funds once this thing is enforced consistently within those two counties. And like John indicated, there was a lot of confusion initially about, well, is the Department of Taxation sending out people to issue these infraction notices, or how is this going to work? And what's the form going to look like? And we've got to get our ordinances drafted to correct this whole thing. And we're finally through the point now where we're hoping to see some funds start to roll our way from this pot of money. So we're kind of excited about that. Interestingly enough, we've just discovered within Washoe County there were two somewhat challenges or questions about the way this bill or way this law is written. The first one is that it says that the owners will train staff they hire. Well, we had one owner that challenged getting a citation because he said, I didn't hire anybody. I'm the owner, and I'm the one that does the selling. I'm just a, you know, one two-man band. It's just me and my wife here. Well, so now we had to go get a legal opinion on that, and yes, he does have to get trained like everybody else, even though he's the owner. The other one that was a challenge was we have a lot of outdoor special event things going on in Carson City, like chili cook-offs or Biggie. I mean, they're all over the place, and people open up their beer tents and sell. They said, we were challenged at our big farmer's market in Sparks. They said, well, these individuals are not hired. They're volunteers. They're the Rotary Club or the Elks Club. We're not hired. We're volunteer staff. So we're not falling under this law either. So again, we got another legal opinion, and yes, because they are serving and selling alcohol, the intent of the law is that yes, they must be trained before they go hit their beer tent. So those were two of the challenges that came up to us. And how we roll this forward, we're trying to do it. What I found works in a state like Nevada, where you're dealing with a lot of good old boy structures in some of these areas, they don't like it when you come in with a new heavy hand, especially when it comes to alcohol and serving and selling alcohol. So we try to come in with that kinder, gentler approach. Instead of going out and doing citations looking specifically for people that don't have these cards, we're adding it on as something we look at when we go in to do our compliance checks. On our form for the compliance checks, there's that box the officers look for saying, were they or were they not have they completed a server training? At that point, if they have not, then the notice of infraction is issued. Can officers be more aggressive if they know that there's a store in violation, they believe kids are buying from there all the time? Yes, they certainly can. But as a rule of practice, right now, we're just doing it as part of the compliance checks for selling alcohol to minors. And let's see, do we have one more slide here? This thing is scrolling. Okay, no. Now it's just questions. So back to our meeting facilitator.
Thank you. One of the questions that's been posed in the chat portion of the slide here, the RBS, the training cards that are good for 4 years, are those given to the individual or the retail outlet?
It's given to the individual.
Okay. And are violations and infractions during compliance checks? Are they given during the compliance checks, or do they and do they check all the employees for cards?
Yes, they do. When we when they go out and do it, let's say they go and hit a convenience slash gas store like 7-Eleven, they will go to each employee in there, since anybody has the ability to serve the alcohol, and they will make sure they all have their cards, and that also includes some of the stores do have security, so they're also going to be required per the law to have a card.
Great. It's time now to hear from our listeners. If you have a question that you'd like to provide to our panel, please follow the instructions that are provided have been provided by our operator. Ruthie, could you refresh us with the directions on asking questions?
Absolutely. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. Star 1 for questions, and make sure your mute function is turned off on your telephone. And at this time, no one is signaling. We'll
okay.
offer another opportunity. Star 1, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay. Our friends in South Carolina, what challenges did you see bringing – you've got a lot of agencies that are working together there. What challenges did you experience, and how did you overcome them in such a multi-agency effort?
Well, that is a good question, and just like a lot of things, when we first start out in the areas that had really no or very little enforcement, there were challenges getting folks on board. But initially, because of the small amount of funding that was provided through the state, through DEOTIS, they were able to use that as incentives to bring agencies on board. And just like a lot of things, even in the areas that already had existing alcohol enforcement teams involved with their coalition, things that are successful the next year, because we've been doing this since 2007, we've seen every year more agencies come on board. We have roughly 265 law enforcement agencies in our state. And when we first started, we had about 110 agencies involved. The second year, that number increased, and now we have we just started our fourth year. But this past year, we had about 220 plus agencies involved. So it's just like with anything, success brings other folks on board, and we just gently pushed, encouraged our alcohol enforcement teams to push in their communities to bring those folks on board as they went along.
As we know, in many of the areas, we tend to sometimes still have turf issues. I suspect that a large piece of your success in South Carolina had to do with leadership.
Yes, and could I also share with you that all of the state recommended, you know, whom you might work with. There was a strategy to develop a memorandum of agreement, and that was left up to each individual circuit as to which law enforcement agency would be involved, which county agency would be involved, and those people were encouraged to establish a memorandum of agreement amongst themselves on the local level. So I think even as, you know, it sounds enormous on the state look at it, but on a local level, we selected those organizations locally, the law enforcement with the largest jurisdiction, and it were the ones we could work most closely with, and the ones who were willing to come together and join and sign a memorandum of agreement.
And to add on to what Mary Lynn was saying, I thought about something while she was talking. In our state law allows any police executive, either chief or sheriff, to call on another law enforcement agency within South Carolina to assist. So what that means is some folks may think in terms of that it's a local initiative, say a county sheriff may call on a local municipal agency to come on board, and then they in turn give them arrest power. But what that means in our state, because of our law, we could actually have adjoining counties working together. During the summer, we had in our Myrtle Beach area, they'd have 400 to 500 officers from across the state come there and help. So we already had an established working together. And in how that translates into some AET teams, as Mary Lynn was saying, some of our teams, they do not cross jurisdictional boundaries. They work in their particular area, and it's coordinated in that two or three or four county area to where everybody does things together. In some occasions, they may only stay in the county. And then we do have some teams that actually work the entire judicial circuit that may either be two counties, three counties, four, or in one case, we've got a five-county judicial circuit. So, you know, it just depends on the local area. I think one of our biggest strengths in South Carolina, even though it's a statewide initiative with a local emphasis, is that, as Mary Lynn said, is that the folks are actually able to do things locally as they are able to get it done.
Thanks, Mike. Ruthie, any questions in queue before I ask another?
No, sir. No one has signaled on the phones.
Okay, thank you. Kathy or John, in Nevada, you've got some what I would call some outstanding fines that have been included in your law. I'm curious to know what the community response has been to the fines, which are pretty hefty.
Well, so far in Washoe County, they've issued enough fines to collect a little over $7,000. I don't know how that breaks out, but I'm assuming that they're probably all first offenses. And we have not had anybody complaining as of yet. They've been given plenty of opportunity. We worked real closely with the Retailers Association and the Convenience Store Petroleum Marketers Association and even the Restaurant Association. I had lengthy conversations with all those guys prior to when we were testifying on this bill and getting it pushed through. And what we did is we even stalled implementing this law from July 1st, when it should have gone in, to October 1st to give everybody in those counties an opportunity to get their people trained for free. And we had a number of free trainings available to everybody, so there was really no excuse for people not being trained.
One of our viewers has asked how often that your compliance checks are being conducted and if there's a practice on how often they should be conducted.
Well, in Nevada, we do not have a statewide ABC, so the enforcement of underage laws is up to each local entity, and we work with them independently. We find that in some areas there's more of an issue with third-party purchasers, or there's more of an issue with juvenile parties. So we listen really closely to our local law enforcement and look at our needs assessments and gear those things accordingly. We mandate that every area that gets UDL money must do a compliance check no less than quarterly, no less than once every 3 months. But we have a lot of areas that do it more frequently just because that is their problem. These kids are getting it through the businesses. So we try, again, to keep an ear to the local areas and work with them on how often they do those compliance checks.
Yeah, on the average in Las Vegas here, we have 8 area commands now for serves about just over 2.5 million people, and we do, if you'd average out, probably about 3 compliance checks a month.
Excellent. Thank you. Ruthie, any calls?
No, sir. We can remind everyone, *1 if you'd like to ask a question on the telephones. No one is signaling, sir.
Excellent. Well, I think we'll close our call. On behalf of OJJDP and the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, I'd like to thank our guests. We had Michael George, Mary Lynn Tollison, and Deputy Danny Blackwell from South Carolina, and Officer John Schutt and Kathy Bartos from Nevada. And thank you, our audience, for calling in and participating. If you have additional questions related to the call or anything we haven't addressed or answered today, feel free to email me at relrick@pyre.org. That appears on your screen. I'll be happy to get the answers for you and get you connected with the resources. A reminder that the views expressed here today are not necessarily the views of OJJDP or the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation and are solely those of the presenters and audience participants on our call. In closing, I'd like to remind you that our project is a resource for your use, and we're available to provide support through our toll-free number at 1-877-335-1287, or visit us on the web at www.udetc.org for more information. As I mentioned earlier, this presentation has been recorded, so for those of you who would like to obtain a copy of the presentation, you can download this and our other presentations in the past from our website. My thanks again to you, the audience, and our speakers for joining us this afternoon. I hope you'll join us again in the future for a future audio conference. Until then, continue the good work that you're doing in your communities. So long.